Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place.
All right.
Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and today I've got a great guest. We're talking to Jeff Zona. Jeff's a guitar player who's featured in the Spotlight column of Guitar Player magazine at the ripe old age of 19. He earned a Bachelor of Music degree from the USC School of Music in studio and jazz guitar. He's recorded several original projects as an instrumentalist and songwriter, and has also written a guitar instruction book called Chord Voicings for Guitar. Currently based out of Nashville, Jeff's toured with successful country artists such as Grammy Award-winning and five-time CMA vocalist Lee Greenwood, Grammy winner David Ball, and Lori Morgan. Other artists he's worked with include Clay Walker, Steve Holy, Pam Tillis, Craig Wayne Boyd, Lindsay L., Trent Tomlinson, Tammy Cochran, and CMA songwriter D. Vincent Williams and the Nashville All-Stars. Jeff was the featured guitarist and vocalist in One, which is a show at the Alabama Theater in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. He performed regularly there with Herb Reed's original Platters. His numerous television appearances also include TNN and CMT, and among all the musical projects he's involved with, he considers the many performances on the Grand Ole Opry to be the highlights of his career. Jeff also owns a recording studio where he produces not only his own music, but also music for other artists around the country. His third and latest release, Here Comes Life, was produced entirely in this studio. Jeff, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, so talk about your Grand Ole Opry appearances. I could definitely see why that would be the highlight of career, but why are they so special to you?
Well, first of all, when you come in the parking lot, you know, you got to get signed off, have your name on the list. And even just from the very start of coming through that entrance, that back entrance, Grand Ole Opry, right at the top of the canopy. And the excitement just starts from there. And once you start seeing people even before you get in the door that you recognize.
Really?
It's just a hodgepodge of just artists and musicians. Oh, I think I recognize that guy. Oh, that's so-and-so from so-and-so's band. And, you know, and this is really before you even get through the door. When you get through the door, everybody, there's hallways and everybody has their own dressing room. There's usually, you know, 10 to 15 artists that are playing that night, and they all leave their dressing room doors open. So when you walk through the halls to get to your dressing room, you get to see people jamming, and it's a great place to catch up with. You obviously usually run into people that you know, some people that you don't know that you might just meet. And it's just very exciting because they're all there in one place at one time. And I'm not even getting to the fact that when you get on stage, how exciting it is. I mean, one of the last times I was there, I think it was last year, actually, because I played there with Lee Green when I played there with Lori Morgan and Clay Walker. And it just seems like every time I'm there that when you're on stage, there's some excitement that you can't explain, and the house is always full when you look out in the audience. It's a big stage. It's been, you know, there's iconic artists been there. It's the Grand Ole Opry, and you feel it without being able to explain what that feeling is. It's just a feeling of reverence, and you even sense it with the artists that you're playing with. You sense it with the people that are performing. That you would think, well, this is old hat to them. And every time you think it might be old hat, it's like every time you're there, it's that same old excited feeling, you know. So I can remember last year when, you know, they usually pick an artist that hosts the show. And I'm on stage right, and Lee's in the center, and, we've got the whole band. But who is announcing and who's hosting? It's Ricky Skaggs, and he's like three feet from me. So it's kind of like, this is so odd. I'm right here just looking at Ricky Skaggs announce us, and he's right there 3 feet from me. And, you know, it's just a reverent feeling and experience. And I think it's hard to put your finger on exactly how to describe it, but that's a good start. It's a real, real fun place.
And that doesn't go away. The more you play it, it's not like you get used to it. You still get to that same
Yeah, you get rush. That same feeling. Yeah. You know, and I'm sure it's different for maybe the house band. They're there, you know, every week, you know, and they're all really nice guys and very well-respected players. And I've gotten to know several of those guys and played with them. It might be different for them, but it just seems like for all the rest of us who are doing guest performances on there, it's never changes. It's just that excitement in the air there. It never goes away.
When you first said that everybody leaves their door open, I was surprised. But really, if I look back, everybody in Nashville, every artist I've spoken to is extremely warm and like giving. So maybe is that a Nashville thing, an extension of that?
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, I think a lot of the country artists in the community are very approachable. And if they do have any pretensions, they definitely don't wear it on their sleeve. And the Opry, I don't know if it's just a tradition that, you know, you could close your door but I rarely ever see a dressing room door closed. And I think that's a good sense of community. And Nashville's known for that, so.
Yeah, it is. And I would say as somebody who's visited Nashville as a tourist, the people that live there are equally, I mean, my wife and I were overwhelmed with just how everybody was just genuinely nice. It was the nicest place I've ever been, except maybe equal Hawaii was very nice as well. But
oh, right, right.
It's just, yep. You know, people are just like genuinely just nice. Like when they say, y'all come back and see us when you go to a restaurant or a grocery store or whatever, it's like you get the feeling they actually mean it. You know, it's not like lip service.
Right.
Which is
that's true. Cool. That's true. The people are genuine and approachable. And I tell you, the only thing that will affect that is the traffic.
Hey, it's like that everywhere, I think. Yeah. Hey, you just released your third CD, Here Comes Life, and that was done entirely in your studio. How was that? The recording process or the overall experience versus your first two CDs?
Well, that was a project that I was prompted to do from, you know, people who were coming to see me at the theater and seeing me perform. They were kind of wondering, well, when are you going to do a project that features your guitar playing? So I made it a point to record a few instrumentals that in my mind weren't so crazy out there, jazz outside, you know, anything that might lose the average listener. I kind of tried to make those a focus that would be accessible enough to the average listener, but yet interesting enough for a musician to listen to. And that's how that project came about. And it didn't fully focus on instrumentals. I had some songs on there. I had a little bit of help, but I tell you that after coming back to Nashville the second time and realizing when you're in a town like this where there's so many studios and so many good musicians, it behooves you to enlist as much help as you can afford to. You know, it costs money to record. It costs, you know, it costs people's time. You got to pay people. It's all worth it because that project, I did as best as I could to do as many things by myself as I could. So I mixed it, and it was all a good learning experience. And I had that been that much better at recording in a home studio. The way I actually went about a lot of those tracks was I had Craig Morgan's drummer, who used to live in Myrtle Beach too, Russ, he came over and we tracked the drums and acoustic guitar down at the same time, and I overdubbed a lot of the other stuff. Hmm. Which a lot of people, you know, have done it that way. You start out with a scratch guitar and you try to get the best drum tech you can, and then that's the main concern going on your initial tracking. However, if I had to redo it, I would probably just spend more money on it and get all the players to track at one time. And I would probably hone the songs. There are a few songs on there that probably weren't ready to be put to tape yet, but I'm actually real proud of a few of those instrumentals on there. And there's kind of an achy breaky backstory to that particular project, because, and I say achy breaky heart because this is one of those songs that I heard Billy Ray talk about. Why? We had no idea that was going to be such a huge hit. Well, on this Here Comes Life project, I recorded a song for my late grandpa Zona. And it's almost an autobiographical, well, it was an autobiographical song about how he affected my sister and I. And I was able to take all his old reel-to-reel recordings that I eventually, years and years ago, had transferred to DAT tape. Well, I had the DAT tapes put over to hard disk. And I, with the courtesy of Pro Tools, I could weave in and out excerpts of him interviewing us as kids.
Wow.
In his third floor attic in New York. We used to go visit him once a year. And that song turned out to be the highlight of the project.
Wow.
And he used to do this he used to play this song for us. He called it Sapunya, and it was a marching band song, and it was a song that he heard every year when the parade came through his town, and I used that as the theme behind the whole song. And anyway, it turned out to be the most talked about song of the whole project. So, and it's actually called Sapunya on there, and that song is available. It's available on iTunes. I got some of those projects on iTunes and CD Baby and stuff. So,
awesome.
It's amazing how that song came out to be the most talked about one on the project, and it is completely autobiographical. The words and everything are all true tales about our growing up experiences with him.
That's very cool. So it was like very nostalgic for you, and it was turned out to be rewarding.
Nostalgic.
Yeah.
What happened, that he passed away when he was 90, and they had a celebration for him on his 90th birthday. He was still living, and I got to play him the first rough mix of this song.
Oh, very
cool. It was amazing to see the look on his face and the smile that he had when he heard this song. And it was only a couple months later that he passed away, but he got to hear the song before that. So it's a good experience. And it's just one of those things that you never expected, that little diddly of the song would be what it became. But it really touched my family a lot too. So,
well, that's awesome. I'm glad you get to experience that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Do you, I interviewed, I don't know if you know, do you know Dave Baker?
Yes, I do.
So I interviewed Dave, and one of the things I asked him, because he has a CD that came out, and I
just saw for him a couple of weeks ago on his Monday night gig downtown.
he's a great guy.
Yeah.
And I asked him this question, and now that you've gone through that, I'd like to ask it to you. What was the primary difference with you recording in this studio for yourself versus when you're in the studio for others?
The primary difference is that you don't have someone to say, no, that's perfect. Don't touch it. So you get to, if you're doing it for yourself, you can get carried away with indulging your perfectionism and your pickiness.
That's exactly the answer Dave gave. It's a lot more nerve wracking, basically.
Yeah. It's easier to record for others, I think.
that's almost verbatim what he said.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
A lot more pressure, you know.
Yeah, it's just
more nitpicky, mm-hmm. like you said.
Exactly. Yeah. I like having someone else's opinion. You know, and that's one of the things that when you're doing tracks via online.
Mm-hmm.
It's always in the back of my mind thinking, God, I wish this person were here. So that way they could, you know, what if they are completely thinking about something else that I'm playing? You know, what if I'm not in the right vibe? And it's nice to have, when you're recording with other people in the room or You have the client there, and it, you know, if they had the producer there, that would be even better, because you would know that what you played was exactly what they wanted, and if it wasn't, you get to redo it there on the spot. That's kind of one of the things that always concerns me about doing tracks online, is, you know, making sure that you are playing what they, because sometimes they can't, they don't know how to explain it, what they want.
Sure.
And so, you know, in that sense, that's always been a concern of mine when you're doing a thing online. But yeah, much easier if the person's there that you're recording for, and even easier if there's other guys around, you know. So,
but as time goes on, the percentage of music, of the total music being made that is recorded where you have multiple guys in the studio, is getting less and less and less.
True. Yeah, true. Oh, I know. Yeah. I know. I just bought a drum set off a guy. I finally, you know, one of my goals was to have my own drum set always mic'd up, so I could just call a drummer and have him come over here. He can bring a snare drum, maybe some cymbals. I mean, I got it. I got everything now. So I'm really looking forward to setting that up, because for me, I'd like to focus on just maybe producing or just playing guitar, maybe, or singing. And this way I can have a drummer come over, and instead of me trying to fuddle through on Superior Drummer and program something, I could just have a guy come over and just play exactly what I want.
Sure.
You know? So
totally get it.
Yeah. And, but some guys are whizzes at it. I mean, that's the new songwriter model, it seems like now, is guys who can program some tracks by themselves, and they, you know, and they might hire an electric guitar player or a steel player to come over and overdub, but they're doing a lot of stuff themselves. And, you know, in some of this new country stuff, you can't necessarily, unless you pick it apart, you can't tell that it's maybe not a real drummer or bass player or whatever, but you're right. The new model is sort of changing, but I think it's going to come back around the other way. But I mean, as many studios as there are here, it's a little bit unfortunate that there's not a little bit of a budget for a band, at least a rhythm section, to come in and knock out these songs, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, you know, Jerry McPherson.
Yeah.
I interviewed Jerry, and he said the thing he's grateful for the most is that he still gets to play the old fashioned way for a living. Like, he's in there with everybody, you know, he's one of the, you know, it's one of the few sort of, like, you know.
Yeah. He's done well. And that's, he's kind of lucky that he's gotten to the point where he's, you know, doing the 1%.
Yeah. Basically, and he said, and he's grateful for it. He goes, you know, that I get to play in a studio like the old school way with other musicians on a regular basis. I'm so thankful for that, because it's such a rarity nowadays. So
it's taken back to what you'd asked me about. You know, that project is, had I gone back and taken more time with it, I probably would have. That's the one thing that sticks in my mind, is that I would have went ahead and enlisted more help, because it's more fun that way. And sure, you might get better results. Granted, if you're Stevie Wonder, it doesn't matter. You're just, you know, you'd rather just do it yourself. And, you know, he's one of my main musical influences, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I have to record my projects that way. I like having the other musicians. Of course, I had real musicians on that project. But if I would do it over, I would enlist more help from the ground up, which means I would co-write more, and I would track more with more than one or two players at a time. I would do all that.
Sure. Well, it's probably like nothing, like everything else we do, you know, that was your first crack through that in that situation. And you learn. It's like you know, that's no different than any other project that any of us does. It's, you know, the first one is where you get all your, the bulk of your education.
Right. Well, part of that was, I was in Myrtle Beach at the time as well. And there's not the breadth of resources that there is here.
Yeah.
I took it upon myself to just do more things myself. And And you know, some of the stuff turned out pretty well. Some of it probably was could have been better if I had, you know, taken more time with it and done some more nitpicking beforehand. So,
what are you working on right now that you're most excited about?
Well, to be honest with you, I am most excited about this space that I have here, and I'm the most excited about getting this studio completely done. That means we got to knock out this wall. I got to put out, have a friend help me put in the, I've got two panes of glass. I'm going to put in a drum room here. We've got a lot of stuff to do yet here, but I'm excited about that because I'm finally at a point now, having been in this place for almost a couple of years now, that while it's about time that I've got to get this all set back up. And, you know, to this point, I've been overdubbing on my laptop using, you know, a smaller interface, and I've got, you know, all the big rig tools kind of, you know, ready to be racked up. So I'm excited about getting the studio completely done so I can, you know, sit down and everything's patched up. It's all ready to go. I can do a full tracking project. I can do an overdub project, no, whatever it may be. But there is some work to be done, and that's what I'm excited about doing, to be honest with you, is getting the studio completely set up again.
That's awesome. Yeah, you were showing me all the adult toys you have there. And I don't mean adult toys as in sex toys, everybody listening. I got to be careful. Oh, he showed me all his adult toys. Yeah,
That's funny. We
don't know each other that well. No, you meant adult, like guy toys, music toys. You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow, that came out weird. ba-dum-bum. Hey, where are you originally from? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I actually grew up in Southern California.
No way.
Yeah. My mom and, we moved from New York.
Where?
I was actually born in Rochester.
Okay. Way upstate there. Right upstate, on the border. Yeah.
Yeah. And, when I was about five, we moved across country to, basically to LA is where we landed. And, not long after, it was Orange County. I went to Fountain Valley High School. I grew up in, you know, in the summers, I could go boogie boarding every day to the beach. It was like 5 miles from the beach. You could take a bus. You could ride your bike.
Very cool.
So I grew up there, and I actually, that's how I ended up going to USC School of Music. My high school, both of my high school music instructors had both gotten their master's from there, and they spoke highly of it, and that's what ended up happening. So I grew up in Southern Cal. That's what I as I like to say. My mom and sister and a lot of that part of the family are in Virginia. So I kind of call Virginia home as well. And many of the artists that I work for, they usually pick a place and they stick with it. I've been introduced as from Southern California. I've been introduced from Virginia, and my mom kind of finds it funny that, you know, well, where are you from again? So when you say I grew up, I did spend most of the time growing up in Southern Cal. So
you have such a strong Southern accent, though.
Man,
that's not from Southern California eating.
No, but it must be by default because I've been in the Southeast for so long now.
Yeah.
It just kind of embedded in, I guess.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What was your childhood like?
My childhood, I'd have to say, was so good. You would have to find really, really dig hard to try to complain about it.
That's great, man.
I mean, you know, my mom raised us and she worked so hard, and we had a lot of independence. My sister and I grew up. She's 5 years younger. We had a lot of independence. We had a lot of time to either be bad or not. Luckily, we came out great, but she did. She was very supportive. It was suburbia. It was Southern California. We had a nice little modest 3-bedroom, 2-bath home, and We had good family life. We always had a uncle or an aunt living with us. My mom was really the rock of her family, and she would, if anybody needed help, she would take them in for a while. And we had really good relationships with all of our aunts and uncles. And man, I just can't say enough about how good a childhood it was. She was very nurturing, and they were so supportive. My mom let my neighbor's dad build a complete soundproofed rehearsal space for a full band inside our garage. My mom was so willing to let me follow my muse that at one point, I recall, I must have been 15, maybe 16, she let me basically move a bedroom out to the garage.
Wow.
And needless to say, or maybe I shouldn't say needless to say, because it's an interesting fact that when in high school, I really was into progressive rock and metal and, you know.
Like who?
Like the early Judas Priest and Iron Maiden, the early Scorpions, the Ulrich Roth. Michael Schenker was one of my big influences as a kid.
Wait a minute, man. I'm going to write this down because you're the first guy in Nashville to tell me that you were into Uli John Roth. That guy was a badass. He played some weird guitars, man, but he was a great player.
Insane. Insane stuff. But they let us build a complete rehearsal soundproofed room in the garage. And when it got wind of it in the neighborhood, people would come over and hang out, and it started to get out of hand. There were people coming over that we didn't know. And it became out of hand, and some of the artwork, should I say, that's a nice way of saying the graffiti on drywalls that people would start writing and leaving their
tags.
Marks.
Yeah.
And we had to tear it down eventually. It just was too much, you know. It just became a hangout for people that we didn't even know, and so we had to chill. Yeah.
That's funny, man.
Yeah, it is funny, I tell you.
You have a 2-year-old, congratulations on that. I would imagine that not only do you appreciate the things your mom did, but it probably gave you a really confident and, you know, good framework to raise your daughter.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to, you know, like I said, I joke about how I waited a long time to finally start a family, but in a way that I'm glad I did, because I feel like when I look back, I wouldn't have been ready for many reasons, but
yeah.
Most of all, I appreciate the opportunity to be a family man now,
sure,
more than I ever would have in the past. And, you know, I'm just more mature in my mind about priorities. And I'm able to accept the shifting of priorities much better than I would have 10 years ago.
Sure.
So, to answer your question, I think it did provide a good framework, and mostly because I'm up to the task, and I'm appreciative of the opportunity to be in this position now. So.
Sure. I could tell you for sure, man. Like, we have 3 kids, and I had my first at 26, which was dumb. But I had my last, I think, at 36, and just the age, and even, you know, that's still young, but just the 10 years more.
Yeah,
you are definitely more patient, more understanding, right, more tolerant, for sure.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think everything you're saying, I agree with that for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And hey, since you mentioned this, I never get to talk about this, man. Let's talk about, like, just for 1 minute, Iron Maiden and the Scorpions and early Priest. Because I like, you know what? I'm one of the few people, I think Iron Maiden was so much better with Paul Di'Anno. Those first two records were awesome.
Man, they were, I tell you. And that's kind of what we, you know, the Killers album was a big thing for us, and God, I can remember us playing you know, these are spotty memories, but they're there. I can remember this band that I had. We played Transylvania.
I know that song.
We played Transylvania in a competition in the high school gym talent contest. And we lost. we lost to my friends who were not as good musicians, but they played the U2.
Oh, of course.
So they won the band slot of the competition.
Yeah.
We were kind of disappointed, but looking back, I could see
you can see why.
I could see why. It was just we were just a little too progressive for the masses there, I think.
Hey, you want to hear a really weird story about one of those records about the Scorpions? It was their album with the kind of white, let me look this up here. It had the yellow cover, one of the real old albums. I'm going to tell you this. Uh-huh. I want to tell you this. This is a really weird story.
Okay.
Let me just look this up. So, okay. It was from Fly to the Rainbow. It's their second album, 1974. Okay. And like, I love that stuff. Lonesome Crow, In Trance, Fly to the Rainbow.
Right.
So when I was a kid, I used to write down lyrics from songs. And, you know, maybe you did the same thing. And, you know, the old school, you'd have to lift the needle.
Oh, yeah. Lift the needle, right?
Put it on. Try to remember as much as you can. Get up. Put the needle back on again, right? So I had this scrapbook, and I had all these song lyrics on. And we moved a few years ago. And so I'm looking at this scrapbook because I'm going through boxes and trying to put stuff away. And it's dated the day I wrote these lyrics was 1977. Mm-hmm. So I come across that page, and I'm looking at the lyrics for Fly to the Rainbow. And all of a sudden, I get goosebumps. And I said, oh, my God. The song I was listening to at that moment on my iTunes 37 years later was the Scorpions' Fly to the Rainbow.
Wow.
That is one of the creepiest things that's ever happened to me. And I have like probably 30,000 songs in my iTunes. What are the chances?
Hmm.
That's a weird connection, isn't it?
That sure is.
I got goosebumps when I realized that it was like, holy smokes. So anyway, Wow. Yeah, this is not about me. This is about you. But
that's funny.
That was a weird story. Okay, so Southern California, was your mom, sounds like she's a stay-at-home mom?
Well, not necessarily. She was a working mom. So we, you know, of course, as we were in school, and I had some neighborhood babysitters. I had a good posse, so to say, in the neighborhood growing up. We had the Woody brothers that I would hang out with. I had a couple of close friends. There were probably 5, 6, 7 of us, you know, that kind of ran in a pack. You know, and back then, you know, what was so cool about growing up, you know, skateboarding was big. We would just ride skateboards. We'd play outside until dark, you know. And I remember later on, we built a skateboard, and we built a half pipe right outside my freaking driveway.
Yeah.
And, God, it's just, you had a lot of room. You know, there's big sidewalks in Southern Cal in the Orange County area, you know, you had sidewalks everywhere, big sidewalks. You could just travel. And, you know, I remember, you know, I was growing up with a lot of freedom. So I'm glad that, you know, I'm sort of well-adjusted.
Within the normal range of the normal dysfunctional. Your dysfunctions aren't outside the norm, the range. What kind of work did your dad do?
My dad was a longtime human resource manager for James River Handicap, who eventually was bought out by Georgia Pacific.
Yeah.
And I think they even might have been bought out one more time, but they made, you know, paper products and stuff like that. Yeah. So he worked a lot doing that. but California back then, I have no complaints about being raised out there and what kind of child that I had. It was great.
at what point did you?
You're getting me to think about this too much now.
Well, that's good. Hey, it sounds
nostalgic. I mean,
well, that's good. It's good memories for you, so that's awesome.
Yeah, it is. It is, and I haven't dug up some of these memories. I mean, in a long time. I mean, the whole thing about the talent show. I mean, I hadn't thought of that in ages. That's funny how that made me think of that. But
all hail Iron Maiden. There you go.
Yeah. Right.
When did you realize, or at what point in time, what was the process maybe of, you said, hey, this, I want to stick with this guitar thing?
let's see. Well, I do know that I really wanted a guitar, and I was begging my mom for a guitar, and she, both of my parents were into really, really good music. When I was a kid growing up, I had really good music to listen to. They had great albums. They had Steely Dan albums. They had rock albums. They had really good jazz albums. And my mom took me to a lot of great concerts. That's another whole thing I could tell you about. I knew when I was, I would say when I was 7 or 8, I was pretty aware of that, how much I was into music. And I had an uncle that was a late born uncle. He was very close to my age. So my grandparents, they had an unexpected child later in life. And this, you know, this might even be relate to one of these other questions you want to ask, but he was into music and I kind of followed him around a lot. He started playing guitar, and, you know, lo and behold, I wanted to play guitar as well. And I don't know if it was just solely because he did, but I know one thing. He didn't show me anything. he would turn his back when he learned something. So, I mean,
really?
It just fueled me. It would just fuel me to want to learn even more. So,
you know who supposedly did that on stage? And I never saw him, unfortunately. I would have loved to. Roy Buchanan. I've read that.
Oh, yeah,
that he, because you know, he'd have nothing but guitar players there, because that guy was, you know, he was that, yeah. He was the guy probably preceded Jeff Beck in his antics, the absolutely. Way he plays it, and if not better even.
Yeah.
And he supposedly turned his back all the time. I never saw him though, so
I haven't heard that it was like an intentional thing, but I bet he was either a little bit shy about performing, but also a lot of guys, they do that because they want to be in contact with the drummer.
Oh, okay.
You know, they want to get closer and share the deal with the drummer, you know.
And he was in California as well.
Yeah.
Like Bakersfield, yeah. I think.
Yeah, I got a couple of his cassettes, bootleg cassettes, that I think I transferred to a disc at one point. He was a real big influence on a lot of the, you know, Nashville guys and others. Just a lot of people were really influenced by him.
Amazing play. I mean, phenomenal player. Just,
yeah.
You can't even describe what he does in words.
Right.
Just
right.
Off the charts. I mean, off the charts, crazy what he plays.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I'm sorry. So your uncle basically made you sorry, man, we're all over the place. Made you have righteous indignation.
Yes.
That, which is a great fuel, because I've done a lot with righteous indignation personally.
So
he made you say, okay, I'm gonna do this on my own,
pretty much. You know, when I used to visit my grandparents, they lived in Connecticut. And he did get me into some good rock and roll. I mean, I'm doing these quotation marks. We played band together.
Mm-hmm.
We were just faking it. We had the badminton rackets and the hassocks, and we played band. I tell you what, he got me into Kiss. He got me into Aerosmith, Grand Funk Railroad. Some pretty good early rock records I was exposed to, and you know. You think about some of those records, Closer to Home, Grand Funk, Aerosmith Rocks.
Yeah. Oh, what a great album.
You know, even Kiss Alive 1, you know, I mean,
great,
it's like,
album.
How could you not get so excited about rock music.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, I had the exposure to it. And of course, as kids, you get a lot of time to mess around with that stuff. And, you know, I only wish that I'd actually taken the leap to actually play a little bit earlier instead of just pretending to play. I mean,
sure.
But hey, you got to start somewhere, right?
Remember that song Black Diamond on Kiss Alive 1? What a great song.
Yeah.
Great,
yeah.
Very cool song. So how did you get into playing country? Because you grew up on the same music pretty much I did.
Man, I tell you what. When I was in college, I went to USC, and I sort of became one of the guys that was a versatile player. And I actually had a friend in college, and actually he's in California. His name is Mike Parsons, and me and him used to get together once a week, and he would show me some bluegrass stuff, and we would play acoustic together. And I really started to get into that. And you know what? I think it was him, now that you ask, I think it was him that first exposed me to Ricky Skaggs.
Okay.
And that pretty much did it. And I was, you know, and of course, then you heard Albert Lee and mm-hmm. Ray Flack, and 'cause he played on the Ricky Skaggs record. And it's just, that's what got me into it. And I need to call that guy because he also went to USC. He lives in Southern Cal still. And I have a cassette tape. I'm revealing my age here with these cassette tape stories.
I think you're younger than me, so you're still safe.
Cassette tapes, and I got one of me and him jamming, and man, I need to put that on to disc before it warps.
So like a lot of guys,
that's how I got into that, and I think it was growing up in Southern Cal, rock was so big and metal, and nothing wrong with that stuff. But by the time I got in late high school, I actually branched out to jazz, and I took classical guitar lessons. I really branched out a lot in my last 2 years in high school. But by the time I got to college, man, when I met Mike, and he exposed me to the Ricky Skaggs stuff and some of the country stuff. And you know who I was into early in college too, was David Grissom.
Oh yeah.
Dog music, because all the dog music stuff had Tony Rice playing guitar with David Grissom. And man, those are some great records.
So you got into country the way a lot of guitarists get into country. They're not into the music. They're into the awesome guitar players that play the music.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, and the Ricky Skaggs stuff is good music. It's all good music, but you know, the David Grissom stuff, that's almost like Newgrass, you know, at the time.
It is. I have some old recordings of, I think, him and Jerry Garcia, I'm pretty sure.
Oh yeah, right.
Grissom
and
Garcia.
He certainly branched out, but some of those couple records that he did, just great playing, you know, great band. And, you know, of course, being exposed to Tony Rice playing bluegrass guitar, I mean, that's just, you can't get any better than that.
And what prompted you to move to Nashville? When did that happen?
Man, it happened, it happened the first time in 1990. And I had a pretty crazy ex-girlfriend that came here first.
So, God bless her.
we all need
one of those.
Yeah,
sometime.
Yeah. You know, and I was this was after college, and I had the last couple of summers in college, I had moved. You know, like I told you, my mom and my family in Virginia, and I ended up staying in Virginia and doing some cool things, but. You know, when I talked to her, and she had already moved out here, she was a singer. I moved out here. She was telling me, you need to come out here and check this out. There's all this talent all around, and these songwriters, man, they do these writers' nights, and you can hear five or six people that just sing incredible, and there's all this stuff going on. And she was right. And you know, at the time I was working a day job. I was delivering computer parts to the Pentagon and back every day.
Wow. So, okay.
Yeah.
This was in Virginia. This is in Virginia.
Yeah, this is in Virginia. This is before you needed a high security clearance. I could never pass it. So one day, you know, I just decided I need to go. And I picked up, I had a little Mazda B2000 truck. And I put everything I own in the back of that truck. And I drove from Northern Virginia all the way to Nashville. And, you know, the rest is kind of history, really. But
cool.
That's how I ended up coming there. And it was a good time. It was a good thing to do.
Let me ask you this. You've done a lot of different things. You had a great career. What are some, you know, we all pay tuition in our businesses, whatever they are. What are some, if you're open to sharing, one or two mistakes you might have made along the journey, and what were the lessons you learned from these mistakes?
I would say, you know, one thing that, well, of course, easier to figure it out looking back at it. One would be to maybe not move so fast. In other words, I feel like some of the mistakes I made were taking one job after another. You know, taking the first gig that comes along, so to say. Mm-hmm. Not that some of the gigs were bad. It's just that if I had known what I know now, I probably would have taken more time off from just going from one gig to another and taking a step back and having it be okay with myself to just say, no, I don't think that's going to work for me right now. And having a more mature insight to the fact that you may do better if you choose the right opportunity rather than, oh, here's an opportunity, I'm going to take it. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's very hard to, if you have a good work ethic, it's very hard to not, you know, you're driven,
yeah,
you're goal oriented, and you're like, your mentality is, I got to make hay while the sun's shining, and you don't realize there's a lot of hay out there. That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I totally get it.
Now, I'm trying to put this in words, but now I just thought of another way I could say this, is that a regret I might have is not taking enough time to look at the whole big picture, because some of the decisions that I made took me away from things that might have led me closer to where I would want to be, if that makes any sense.
Sure, absolutely.
yeah, so, you know, it's good to work. And you know, on the flip side, you know, like I had a long period of time where I was doing that house gig in Myrtle Beach, mm-hmm. and it was a, you know, a good paying, good steady pay gig, you know, and nothing wrong with that. But, you know, there are times where I would think that what I regret is not being able to see that, like you said, there's a lot of hay to be made out there. And it's okay if you're not working. That's okay to be like, in other words, it's okay to be out of work for a little while, because you know what? You're honing your craft. And something is going to present itself, and it could be way better than something that you just accepted 6 months earlier. I mean, there's so many. That's the thing. There's so many opportunities that can come along. It's just you have to be a little more patient. And it's one thing that I would regret is to not slow down a little bit and look at the big picture of some stuff, and be okay with not saying yes to everything.
Yeah, I get that for sure, man.
Yeah.
And I think unless you have a mentor that you're working with, or unless you've been, like I interview a number of artists where their mom and dad was in the business. And mm-hmm. so they've got a history but I think unless you have that, that's a very hard thing to do as a young person with a strong work ethic that wants to work. And you know, you run on fear more often than not when you're young, and right. that's just the nature of being younger.
Yeah.
So I totally get that.
Absolutely.
The flip side of that, what are one or two things you did which might have been out of your comfort zone at the time, but hindsight 2020, they turned out to be really good decisions?
Let's see. Well, I think one of them was when I had to audition to get into USC School of Music, and I remember being so driven to do that. And I remember being, you know, that fear of, oh, what if I, you know, don't play this right? Or, you know, I remember having the guitar and practicing scales in the back of the car on the way as my mom is driving me to, you know, the audition. You had to audition for the faculty before they could, you know, sure. figure out what they're going to accept you into it. And, you know, that was really outside of my comfort zone. And, but I'm glad I did that because, I think that, you know, the experience makes you more knowledgeable. And, you know, that was on the, you know, going to college and being exposed to some of the great other, there's a lot of nice people, helpful, but there were the fellow students and a lot of the guys that were ahead of me getting their master's at the time were very talented folks. So to be around that, that was a good move at the time. I think the other thing that might have been, I would say, outside of my comfort zone is when I got wind of auditioning for Greenwood back in the early 90s, you know, there were a lot of guys that had auditioned for that gig, and I didn't really, it was almost like a sort of a ignorant naivety that I just kind of came in and I didn't really know what I was going to play. I didn't know what the songs were. And as I was waiting in his warehouse, I saw a cassette of one of his albums and I put it on there, and I had like, it seemed like a long time, but it was probably only 20 minutes where I was waiting for it to be auditioned. Man, I learned two or three of his songs while I was waiting. And it was like, I wasn't nervous or anything. It was an interesting experience being, you know, in my early 20s doing that. And just, you know, that was a great experience. And, you know, I take with me that confidence and some of that, in a way, it was kind of that naivety that I had that actually helped me in that situation. And, you know, I think I have to attribute some of that to having some developed ears to be able to learn something on the fly like that. And
that's what I was thinking when you told me that. I said, my God, your ears must be phenomenal.
I did well in that particular case. And you know, he had me back to sing around the piano a second time, and that pretty much sealed that deal. And that was a good experience. That was a good you know, milestone for me.
But sometimes when the universe is behind you on something,
yeah,
it's like you can't screw up. You know, when something's meant to be. Mm-hmm. And I hate to be so, well, you're from Southern California, so this is normal talk for you. When something, you know, when something's meant to be, and it happens, man. I mean, like, what is a series of dots that had to be connected? You had to have that time to wait. That cassette tape had to be laying there, and then there had to be something to play it on.
Mm-hmm. Now,
what's the likelihood of all that lining up?
Oh, I know. I'm telling you,
that's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
Let's talk. Do you remember the first record or CD you ever purchased?
You know, I thought about this as a two-part question because, um, I was trying to think of this, and I was trying to think, well, which one did I actually buy? And then I started thinking about, well, wait a minute, what's the first record that I got by myself, that I got on my own? Is that kind of the...
No, you tell me. Just the first record that came into your possession that you bought, or that someone bought for you and you got listened to.
Right, right. I'm trying to... That's a tough question, because I want to go back. I want to go back very, very far. Like I said, my parents had really good records at my disposal. And, I can recall, showing my age again, but I could recall some 45s that came into my possession that were, that I have memories of them. And I'll tell you which ones. I could say Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress.
Oh, what a great song, man.
And,
I love that opening line. That's one of the, it's one of the top opening lines of the song, you know?
Yeah. I remember a 45 of Benny and the Jets.
Oh, another great song.
Yeah. It's funny, cause I remember so many great, albums that my mom had that I could just put on. I do remember that, my mom's best friend at the time got me a birthday gift, and it was wrapped. And it was, I was like, I don't, it may sound like I was being a snotty kid or something, but I was like, oh my God, I hope it's the Elton John album. I hope it's the, and there was some Elton John album that I'd heard about. And I opened it up, and it was Alice Cooper. And I was like, and it was, I think it was Alice Cooper. Was it Killers? The one with the snake on the front?
I don't know the cover of the Killers album.
Yeah, yeah. So it was an Alice Cooper album that I came to love. it had Under My Wheels was one of the songs on that album. Great song. I loved.
Okay, I'll tell you right now, it is Killer. Yeah, with the snake on the front.
Yeah.
Killer. Yep. Yeah, Under My Wheels is the first song.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was just it wasn't Elton John, but I think it was even better. My parents had a lot of great albums too that I listened to. And
you ever hear that song? I'll tell you my favorite Alice Cooper song. It's a weird song. It's called The Ballad of Dwight Frye.
I have heard it.
It's on Love It to Death. It's kind of a weird song. It's not a typical Cooper song.
Right.
I heard that one night on Fingers Metal Shop. I grew up in New York City, and they used to have this song from WBAB, Babylon, Long Island. I'd listen to every Sunday night at midnight. I'd bring in the transistor radio, sit it next to my bed, and check that out. And I heard that song.
Well, let me tell you this. I mean, I've got my parents have a story that they love to tell. They took me to a Three Dog Night concert when I was 3 years old.
Awesome.
And they put me on their shoulder the whole time. Well, when the concert ended, I threw a temper tantrum.
Really? Because it was over?
Because it was over.
Oh, you didn't realize it's not like Disney World. Like, you can't keep going the next day or stay there as long as you want. That's funny.
Yeah, so... that was obviously an influential band on me as a kid. It was Three Dog Night.
Great band.
They have pictures of me with headphones on when I was just a youngster. I was probably three, maybe even four. I don't know. But I have a picture somewhere, and I should dig it up. And I'm looking at the album cover, and I got the headphones on, and it's the band.
Man, if you send me that picture when I post your interview to my website, I will put that picture on it.
Okay, well, I'm gonna find the picture, because my mom's here with me this week, and we'll, between the two of us, we're gonna find that picture, and I'm gonna send it to you.
Yeah, man, that'll be the picture I use on my website.
There's I think there might be another one too, and the other one get this, I had the chance as a kid to just put on any old Led Zeppelin record. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a picture of me. I think it's Zeppelin 4.
Yeah, man. Send one of those pictures and on the EveryoneLovesGuitar.com website.
Okay.
You know, on iTunes, I can't put it, but on the EveryoneLovesGuitar.com website, I will put that picture right next to your interview. So it'll show it just like, it'll be very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool, man.
Okay. Okay.
Hey, this is probably a difficult question to answer, as steeped in music as you are, but if you weren't doing what you're doing now, what do you think you'd be doing instead?
Well, I always thought that what I would be doing, what I'd want to do, not that I'd know that I'd be doing it, is to be an ad guy. In other words, I would want to create ads.
Sure.
I would want to create commercials.
Okay, so TV ads.
I would be in marketing.
Okay. You know that's what I've done for the last 18 years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you told me that. And that, yeah, it's just a coincidence,
yeah,
that you do that. And I always thought that what would be so cool is to be one of the guys that gets to be paid to create clever ads for companies that need advertisements, whether it be magazines or TV, radio. That's what I'd want to do.
Well, we need to find out how to swap lives for like a month, because I'd love to play guitar professionally. so I would gladly give you,
sure,
loan you my skill set for a month for without a problem to get yours.
Are you sure you could afford the cut and pay?
To experience that, I could do anything. It would be a labor of love, let me tell you. You know,
okay.
I know you just had a daughter 2 years ago. Are you married?
Well, I am, for all technical purposes, yeah.
Well, was that a trick question?
No, not a trick question. Yeah, I have a significant other, and she's a big part of my life.
Oh, no, I didn't. And, yeah, you know what? I need to rephrase that, because, like, no one's married nowadays, and it's not a big deal.
Well, that's not true. I mean, we're, you know, we'll end up getting married. It's just, to be on a personal level, you know, I had a couple past marriages, and not that there was any, I don't hold any, ill will towards any of my past ex-wives, because I wasn't as ready as much as they weren't.
Sure.
And I probably had as much or more to do with it not working out than they did.
Sure.
So I developed a little bit of a phobia of like, hey, I don't want to mess this up right now, man. You know, let's just, but at the same time, we had a child together on purpose. So there's a lot of planned things going on there. And I feel pretty lucky that things turned out the way they did. So for all intents and purposes, yeah, I am.
how'd you guys meet?
We actually met online, which is a little scary.
No, everybody meets. I mean, it's the best thing. It's like, because you have a qualified, you're prospecting in a pool of qualified people, like, that they're all, they're open and they're interested in a relationship. I think that's you know, I've been with my wife 25 years. I don't know how I managed to stumble into that good luck, but if I had, it's not going to happen, but I'd look online for sure. It's just, as a marketing guy, man, I want to go where all the leads are.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, there are horror stories, especially from the woman's perspective, about people portraying what they're really not online. And once you get to know them, and you know, then the truth comes out, kind of thing.
Hey, that's no different in reality.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I have experience with that with you know, and I started with that because when I was in Myrtle Beach, being such a transient town that it is, tourist town, you know, it's kind of hard to meet people over there without some help in terms of who's really local and who's, you know, who's for real or what. So that's how that started. And I, you know, when I moved back to Nashville the second time, I was kind of, you know, I kept some of that going, but it worked out all right.
Very cool.
I think Nashville is such a bigger city that I probably would have been okay without that. But it's such a big place now that it's hard for, as a musician, to rely on people coming into the bar or the club or on the gig or whatever to meet somebody.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's a tough one. So that's why people end up And that's, you know, one reason I end up going to that route. So,
hey man, I know exactly how you feel, because I was married when I was really young, and yeah. Then when my current wife and I were going to get married, I remember the only reason I did it was because I had more confidence in her decision making than in mine.
Right.
Like I knew, like she had a couple opportunities to be married and she didn't. And I said, well, I know that my thinking is not right, and that's because I've had this bad experience. But I know her thinking is right, and I can trust that.
Right.
And I remember the day of the wedding, I was so nervous. I didn't even smoke cigarettes. I bought a pack of cigarettes. I started to smoke. I was so scared, and here we are, 25 years later. So I was glad that I was at least had a little bit of sense to.
That's great, man.
And we actually genuinely like each other. Not 100% of the time, of course. That's not realistic. Right. But like, you know, almost 100% of the time. So
you're doing them a lot better than some others. And congratulations on.
Thanks. Yeah,
making it work, you know. And,
yeah, we're not grinding through it. We do make it work. And that's like a business, man. If you don't work this thing, if you don't work that relationship, it's not going to work. Just like your business. Yeah. If you stop playing guitar and stop putting your name out there, you ain't going to get gigs.
Right. Exactly.
Real simple. And it's the same thing with a relationship. For me, anyway. So, and do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
I do. I love having more time for sports. I love playing basketball when I have the option. My favorite sport, literally, is snow skiing.
Wow, that's interesting.
So, it takes a few dollars to make that happen, and it takes some traveling. But, you know, one of my favorite vacations was flying out to Reno and staying at a really good, decent hotel, casino, for a really good rate, and driving every morning into Tahoe or Truckee, California, and going skiing every day, and come back, have a couple of drinks, play a couple of rounds of blackjack, do it all over again the next day.
Yeah, that's a really, really, really difficult life, I could see.
Yeah. That's my favorite. That's one of my favorite vacations.
Yeah, I can't blame you. That's a pretty good deal. I actually know someone who lives in Truckee, so it's kind of funny you said that. I haven't heard that in a long time.
Well, the reason I mentioned that is there's a little place called Donner Ski Ranch, and some friends of ours that we became to know were actually running that place. And it's funny how out west you can take this small ski resort, and it could be just the most fabulous thing you've ever been on. And that was like one of those places. It wasn't expensive to go there. And of course I love Heavenly and those kind of resorts as well. Well, even going a half day on Heavenly is pretty heavenly. So, but yeah, Truckee, that's where there's a couple little ski resorts that are smaller. That man, they're really fun to go on. So that's how I mentioned that. That's a great little place out there.
There you go. Shout out to Truckee Ski Resorts. Yeah. Hey, I want to be sensitive to time. I got three more questions.
Okay.
Who's had the biggest influence on your life?
Well, I tell you what, my stepdad has been in our lives since we were a little kid, and he has been such a blessing to our family. And, you know, I had this joke a while back. And his name is Brian. We used to call him Uncle Brian, actually, when we were kids. And anyway, so he's fully entrenched in our lives and always has been. And he's just been a rock for my mother. And he's been, he actually grew up with my dad. They went to school together. And how this all came about is kind of a longer story. But everybody's friends with each other. Everybody's close. Hmm. It's all good. But Brian is like what I said that made my family laugh several years ago was like, everybody needs a Brian in their life.
That's cool, man.
And the reason is because when my mom's scatterbrained, when my mom's flustered, Brian will have the answer. He's very logical. He's actually a very smart person. He's got a high IQ, one of those guys. He's got a really dry sense of humor that makes us all laugh. And when there's a problem on hand, he's got the most sensible, logical solution right there at your fingertips.
That's awesome. He should get online with that. Wisdom for hire.com or something like that.
Absolutely.
There's a dire need for that, I assure you.
Yeah. I think he's been a big influence, to be honest with you, because he's had such an impact on my family and been such a blessing to my mom and to us. So that would be my answer.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What's the most important lesson your business has taught you?
The most important lesson. It's a tough one to answer, but then again, it's not, because I mean, you mentioned this earlier in the conversation is to not buy into the fear. Don't buy into it. Get out of your head, because what's in your head a lot of times is just that, and that's all it is. It's being in your head. And if you buy into the fear of, for example, oh man, that guy's not going to call me back. You know, he's got this going on and that. I ain't going to get to play with those guys because, you know, they got their click and blah, blah, blah. And you start having all these silly rationalizations. Well, you know what? Most of the time, it's just not true. Yeah. So don't buy into the fear, because if you feel like you can do something and you want to do something, just do it. And don't make excuses. Because if you have the passion and you know you do, just follow through with it. Because if you don't, you're never going to know anyway. And a lot of times these fears that you have and these so-called excuses are really just all in your head. That's all they are. That's what I've learned.
That's awesome. There's a Mark Twain quote that I always cite at times like that. It says, I've had a lot of worries in my life, most of which never happened.
Yeah, right.
And that's it, man.
That's it.
You know what? Playing guitar, I played music as a kid. I played saxophone. I played at Carnegie Hall. And it was just an opportunity that I had with that one year with the band I was playing with in New York City. And I started playing guitar 2 years ago. And the greatest gift playing guitar has given me is forcing me to be in the present.
Yeah.
Because when you're playing or you're doing a solo, man, I can't think about some shit that might happen tomorrow or something that pissed me off this morning. And somehow I've worked at it, but I've tried to apply that to other areas of my life, and the amount of worry that I had versus now since I've learned that lesson from since guitar taught me that, has really been a blessing, man. It's not there anymore, because I just like, you know what? I'm here right now. If I need to deal with that, there's too much bullshit I have to deal with I don't have any more room to, and some of that is just getting older, I think, but I'm glad it all happened, because it's been a really nice thing that I didn't expect to come out of playing an instrument.
Yeah, because it takes you, it forces you to be right in the moment.
That's it.
So, I mean, that's as good a reason as any.
So practice your guitar, everybody. One last question. This is a tough one. Jeff, what's your definition of happiness?
I tell you what, if I had to answer that, I would say my definition of happiness is contentment. And that would mean being content with who you are and being able to forgive yourself. Those are very important factors for me. which being able to forgive yourself would come with having a sense of humor about your mistakes. And that in itself would also lead to being content. Happiness doesn't have to have, $1 million around every corner. It doesn't have to be about money. It doesn't have to be about physical possessions, because it usually doesn't come down to that. It just comes down to being content with where you are and who you are and finding the good in that. And being able to, of course, enjoy the journey. So those are sometimes they're hard lessons to learn, but for me, happiness is contentment.
Thank you, man. That's a wonderful answer. I can't thank you enough, man, for your time. And I really enjoyed talking with you. This is a wonderful call. And thank you for sharing so much about yourself. Is there anything you'd like to promote? I'm going to first promote your CD. It's called Here Comes Life. Everybody check it out. It's on iTunes and CD Baby. Anything else you want to promote or social media that you want people to find you on?
You can find me on Facebook, and I do have a musician page on Facebook, and I promise I'm going to try to get better about posting more things on that page. A lot of people find me just on that personal page, and you know how those go. The more people you have on there, the more Facebook says, okay, you have enough. That's it. So, I'm not there yet, but, so that's it for, you know, shameless self-promotion right now. I mean, I'm going to, I'll get my website back up, when I have the newest round of original tunes. I will be using those sources, and I will, probably also get the jeffzona.com back up. I initially got just slightly discouraged about how people used social media and Facebook and all that stuff a lot more than websites, but that'll be up, back up and running as well. But man, I appreciate your time, and if feel free to ask me any. You had some guitar questions on there, but I guess you probably had enough gear and gear talk and all that stuff too. So
the conversation's so good, we'll be on here another hour. That's the
that's good. We got a lot of meat and potatoes in this one, didn't we?
Absolutely. I loved it, man, and I can't thank you enough. Hey, everybody, yep. If you want to check Jeff out, his website will be up or should be up soon. It's Jeff Zona, JeffZona.com, or you can find him on Facebook. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. And thanks again so much to Jeff Zona for spending his time with us and for being so open and transparent about everything. And go to everyonelovesguitar.com and sign up to get notified about future episodes of the podcast, along with some cool guitar-related news and updates. I want everybody to be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Until next time, I'm out, everybody. Peace. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.